Deaths from illness and malnutrition were once commonplace, but after the Steeling School was created, only two POWs died, one from a burst appendix. And in so degrading a place, Steeling won back the men's dignity. Weeks passed. The bird attacked Louis relentlessly. Unable to escape, Louis became increasingly angry. His experience in childhood when bullies bloodied him was repeating itself. He lit up with rage. When the bird lunged for Louis, Louis imagined strangling him, and his hands drew into fists. He saw the corporal looking furiously at his hands, but refused to unclench them. The bird demanded that Louis look him in the eyes. Louis wouldn't do it. The bird tried to knock Louis down. Louis wouldn't fall. Other prisoners told him to give in, or the bird would beat him to death. Louis couldn't do it. When he raised his eyes, all that shone in them was hate. A battle of wills had begun. All that fall, the POWs could hear air raid sirens over Tokyo. They were false alarms, but something was coming. Louis watched the sky and hoped the Americans would come before the bird killed him. Chapter 25. He's Alive! On a late October day in 1944, Louis pushed a wheelbarrow into Tokyo, joining a guard to pick up rations. It was the first time he'd passed, unblindfolded, into the society that held him captive. Tokyo was bled dry. The war had caused massive food shortages, and markets were shuttered. Civilians were slipshod and dirty. Children were digging trenches. The Americans were coming, and the city was holding its breath. On a wall, Louis saw a scrawl of graffiti, "Bi Niju Ku." Louis knew Niju meant 20, and Ku meant 9. He walked back to Omori, wondering what B-29 meant, and why someone would write it on a wall. On November 1st, a wondrous new American plane lifted off a Saipan runway. A gigantic craft, it could rocket across the sky at more than 350 miles per hour and carry giant bomb loads over distances no other bomber could traverse. It was the B-29 Superfortress, and it would bring down Japan. All morning the plane flew, splitting the air nearly 6 miles up. Above was a sky of intense blue. Below came Tokyo. B-29s had been used a few times over Japan, launching from a remote area in China that had not been occupied by Japan. Largely because of the difficulty of flying from Chinese bases, the raids failed. But the swift, huge planes terrified the Japanese, inspiring the graffiti Louis saw. Weeks after the first China-based raid, Americans captured the island of Saipan, only 1,450 miles from Tokyo. The B-24 couldn't make it from Saipan to Tokyo and back, but the B-29 could. The November 1st flight was the first run. The plane carried not bombs, but cameras. It was mapping the path of B-29s that would follow. Louis was outside when sirens sounded. Sirens were routine now, so they caused no concern. The guards shooed the POWs into the barracks. Outside, something was different. The guards were gaping at the sky, as if, wrote Bob Martindale, they were looking for the Messiah. Then there was a glint above, a finger pointing urgently, and POWs bolting for the door. Running out, Louis saw a sliver of light over Tokyo, contrails curling behind it like twisting spines. Oh, God, God, An American plane, someone shouted. In Tokyo, civilians stood in the street, their frightened shouts carrying over the water. Louis had never seen a plane like this. Then a new prisoner said it was an American bomber called a B-29. A cheer rang out. Men shouted, B-29! B-29! It was the most beautiful thing Louis had ever seen. As the POWs ran and cheered, Louis glanced to the end of camp. The bird was standing motionless and expressionless, watching the plane. It was not their messiah, Martindale wrote, but ours. The B-29 flew at perfect liberty. The guards pursued the elated POWs, trying to force them into the barracks. The men shushed each other, fearing they'd be beaten for celebrating. The clamor quieted. Louis watched the bomber, occasionally darting between barracks to avoid the guards. The plane crisscrossed overhead for more than an hour, then flew off. The bomber had simply passed over Tokyo, but everyone knew what it meant. Every morning at roll call, the 29th man sang out, Nijuku, at the top of his lungs. Not even bayonet prods, wrote Wade, could wipe the smiles from the POW faces now. The bird wasn't smiling. It was an ordinary day. Louis was in his barracks, sitting with friends. Suddenly, two guards crashed in, screaming, Kirei! Louis leapt up with the other men. In bounded the bird. Looking around, the bird spotted Louis and charged at him. He wore the belt he'd worn on Louis's first day in Omori. The buckle was several inches square, made of heavy brass. You come to attention last! The bird jerked his belt off. Grasping the end with both hands, he swung it back, then whipped it forward like a baseball bat, straight into Louis's temple. Louis felt as if he'd been shot in the head. His legs seemed to liquefy, and he collapsed. The room spun. When he gathered his wits, he was on the floor, bleeding. The bird was crouched over him, making a motherly sound, a sort of, aww. He pulled a fold of toilet paper from his pocket and pressed it into Louis's hand. Louis held it to his temple. Oh, it stop, eh? The bird said, his voice soft. Louis pulled himself upright. The bird waited for him to steady himself. The corporal seemed compassionate and regretful, and Louis felt grateful. The relief was just entering his mind when the buckle, whirling around from the bird's swinging arms, struck his head again. Louis felt pain bursting through his skull, his body going liquid again. He smacked into the floor. For weeks, Louis was deaf in one ear. The bird beat him daily. Louis bore it with clenched fists, eyes blazing. But the assaults were wearing him down. The corporal began lording over his dreams, his features alight in vicious rapture. Louis spent hours in prayer, begging God to save him, and lost himself in fantasies of running in the Olympics. He thought of home, tormented by thoughts of what his disappearance must have done to his mother. One day in mid-November, two Japanese civilians found Louis in his barracks. Friendly and respectful, they said they were producers from Radio Tokyo. They handed Louis a piece of paper. It was a transcript of an American radio broadcast announcing his death. The news that Louis had been declared dead, privately delivered to his family in June, had become public that week. The producers said they were distressed that Louis's family had been told he was dead. They invited him to write a message to his family and read it on a program called Postman Calls. Louis didn't trust them, Postman Calls was a propaganda show performed in English and broadcast to Allied troops to demoralize them. The broadcasters were POWs, known as propaganda prisoners, usually working under threat of execution or beating. Wary of being made into a propaganda prisoner, Louis wouldn't commit. The producers told him to think about it. Louis asked Martindale what to do. Martindale said as long as Louis wrote his own message, there was no harm in accepting. Louis set to work. Knowing his family might not believe it was he added details he hoped would convince them. To ensure his message aired, he decided to speak positively about his captors. He was driven to Radio Tokyo. The producers gave his message a hearty approval. It would be taped for later broadcast. The Japanese planned to use that day's broadcast to tease the audience, then wait 2 days before airing his voice, proof they were telling the truth. Louis taped his message, then returned to Omori. In San Francisco at 2:30 a.m. on November 18th, a young woman named Lynn Moody was working the graveyard shift in the Office of War Information. A colleague was listening to Japanese broadcasts and typing them up for review by propaganda analysts. The colleague asked Moody to fill in during her break. Moody slipped on the earphones. She was startled to hear a name she knew, Louis Zamperini. Moody was a USC graduate, and Louis was an old friend. Moody began typing. Recently, a news report stated that First Lieutenant Louis Zamperini is listed as dead by the United States War Department. Louis Zamperini is alive and well as a prisoner of war here in Tokyo. This is one of the many examples of the men missing in action erroneously reported and later being established as a lie. Much suffering and heartaches could have been avoided by the transmittal of reliable information to the parties concerned regarding the whereabouts of men. So chin up, Mrs. Louis Zamperini. Louis is neither missing nor dead. Keep on listening, Mrs. Zamperini, and don't mention it. The pleasure is all ours. Later, Moody wrote that when her colleague returned, I practically danced around the room, telling her about it. 2 nights later, Moody was back on the night shift when a transcriber yelled to her. Moody ran in and put on the earphones. Hello, America, the announcer began. This is the postman calling and bringing a special message to Mrs. Louis Zamperini. Her son has come down to the studio especially to send her this message of reassurance after the erroneous report of a few days ago by the United States War Department that he was officially given up as dead and missing. A young man began speaking. Moody knew in an instant. It was Louis. Hello, mother and father, relatives and friends. This is your Louis talking. Through the courtesy of the authorities here, I am broadcasting this personal message to you. This will be the first time in 2.5 years that you will have heard my voice. I am uninjured and in good health, and can hardly wait until the day we are together again. I am now interned in the Tokyo prisoners' camp, and am being treated as well as can be expected under wartime conditions. The camp authorities are kind to me. Before I forget it, Dad, I would be very pleased if you would keep my guns in good condition, so we might do some good hunting when I return home. Mother, Sylvia, and Virginia, I hope you will keep up your wonderful talents in the kitchen. I often visualize those wonderful pies and cakes you make. Is Pete still able to pay you his weekly visits from San Diego? I hope he is still near home. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Your loving son, Louis. At the Zamperini house, a military telegram arrived, and on it were Louis's words. The telegram stressed that officials couldn't confirm Louis was really the speaker or a POW. But the Zamperinis focused on one sentence, keep my guns in good condition. Growing up shooting rabbits, Louis was fastidious about his guns. To the Zamperinis, this was the fingerprint, the detail only Louis would have thought to include. Louise and Sylvia began sobbing and shouting with joy. Pete picked up the phone, called a friend, and shouted two words. "He's alive!" Chapter 26 Madness. The Radio Tokyo men were back at Omori, gushing compliments. Would Louis broadcast another message to his family? Louis accepted. But when he arrived in Tokyo, the producers announced a change of plans. They didn't need the message he'd written. They had one already. "Here's me, Louis Zamperini. I was reported to have died in combat. Boy, that's rich. Here I am, just as alive as I could be. This reminds me of another fellow. He told me that he was officially reported as killed in action, but in reality was a prisoner of war. After several months, he received a letter from his wife, in which she told him that she had married again since she thought he was dead. Boy, I really feel sorry for a fellow like that. And the blame lies with the officials who allow such unreliable reports. The least they can do is to let the folks back home know just where their boys are. It's certainly a sad world when a fella is killed off by a so-called official report." Louis was aghast. This message wasn't meant for his family. It was meant to discourage American troops. He refused to make the broadcast. Undeterred, the producers took him on a tour. They took him to a cafeteria and served him a delicious American meal, then showed him a comfortable bedroom. If Louis would do the broadcast, they said, he could live here. They introduced him to three propaganda prisoners. As Louis offered his hand, the men dropped their eyes. Louis knew they were telling him not to accept. Louis suddenly understood why he'd been spared execution on Kwajalein. A famous Olympian criticizing America would be a priceless propaganda tool. He'd been sent to the hell of Ofuna, then to Omori and the bird, to make his life in camp unbearable, so he'd be willing to betray his country to escape it. Smiling, the producers invited Louis to accept this easy new life. Louis refused. The smiles evaporated. They ordered him to do it. He said no. The producers left to confer, then returned. "I think you go to punishment camp," one said. They waited for Louis to change his mind. He didn't. Louis was dumped at Omori. The bird was waiting for him, glowing with fresh hatred. His beatings resumed with intensified vigor. Louis stood his ground with rebellion boiling in him, praying the Americans would come. In the afternoon of November 24, 1944, the Tokyo sirens began to howl. From above came an immense roar. The men looked up to an astounding sight. Acres and acres of B-29s, 111 of them, so high they looked like gleaming slits in the sky. The Americans had arrived. The POWs cheered, calling out to the bombers. The guards stared up, so awed by the planes that they didn't seem to hear the men shouting. As the POWs watched, a lone Japanese fighter raced up, then abruptly, startlingly, flew straight into a bomber, shattering and raining down on Tokyo Bay. The bomber fell, white smoke twirling from it. A single parachute puffed from its side. The bomber hit the water. The lone survivor, under his parachute, wafted into Tokyo. The other bombers flew on. There was distant booming. It was only the beginning. B-29s passed over Omori nearly every day, sometimes lone planes, sometimes continents of aircraft. Sometimes the men saw licks of flame far away, Tokyo's war industries burning. Civilians streamed over the Amori Bridge and camped by the walls in hopes of escaping the bombs. One day, Louis stood outside watching Japanese fighters circling a crowd of B-29s. The battle was so high that only the giant bombers were consistently visible. The tiny fighters flickered in and out of view as sunlight caught them. Every little while, there was a sharp